I want to start with a story that Bhante Sangharakshita tells from the Zen tradition. He tells it in this book, Vision and Transformation. And it's a story that some of you might be familiar with. I was familiar with it, and then we studied it in Mitra study some time ago, and I found myself very, very moved, moved by it. So I want to start with that. Hopefully it'll be connected. It's a story of a young man who's Bhante describes him as a wastrel. So this is in Japan, possibly medieval Japan, and he's a wastrel. I guess what that means is that he misspent his youth on all the things that you can misspend your youth on. He has got to the point where actually that hedonistic lifestyle has disgusted himself. He's got not only fed up with it, but he's full of sort of self-disgust and disgust with life. There's a certain... it's not only run out on him, it's like it's run out and left him very empty. And he decides that the only thing he can do is to go and become a monk in a Zen monastery. That's what you do, I guess, in medieval Japan. So Bhante says that he doesn't actually want to become a monk. It's just that he hasn't got any other options that feel worthwhile in life. So he'll go and give himself to the service of this monastery. Now, I don't know if you know much about Zen, but at least traditionally, it's not easy to enter a Zen monastery. It's not easy to be accepted into a Zen monastery. There's this image that's used about kneeling in the snow. You have to wait outside, kneel in the snow for several days before you're allowed to enter, to show that you're really, really committed, to show that you really want to do it. I sometimes think perhaps the LBC could be a bit more like that. But then I kind of think that actually, were it like that, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here myself. So it's just as well that we're not Zen. and we'd have to kneel in the snow. But anyway, he enters... he goes to see the abbot. The abbot wants to see any new potential novice monk. And the abbot... asks him about his life, and the young man's very open, very honest, and tells him about all the stupid things he's done, about all the immoral things he's done, about how he's wasted so much and probably caused others hurt in the process, and how he's actually just not good for anything. He's got nothing to offer, so he'd like to become a monk. And the abbot says, well, is there anything that you are good at? And the young man thinks for a minute and then says, well, I'm not bad at chess. I can play a game of chess. And so the abbot says, okay. And he calls for a chess board to be brought. And then he summons another monk. He summons an elderly monk who's been there 30, maybe 40 years, is old and haggard looking, but who's obviously good at chess. And so the young man and the haggard monk, the old monk, are seated opposite each other. And then the abbot brings out a sword. He brings out his sword and lays it on the table. And he says, play. Play, and whoever loses, I'm going to chop their head off with this sword. And in the Zen tradition, that's a serious threat. That's a serious thing to threaten somebody with. And Zen masters sort of... you don't quite know whether they're joking or not. So this is sort of deadly serious. And so the sword's on the table. There's these two men sitting opposite each other. And they start to play. And the young man is not bad, actually. He's not bad. But then the old man is not bad either. In fact, he's pretty good. So they're playing this kind of chess game, and at one point the young man sort of really, everything sort of focuses in his mind, and he realizes he's really going to have to play his best if he's going to, well, not only win, but live. And you can probably imagine what's going through his mind, the sort of the nervousness, the anxiety, the adrenaline. But he manages to summon his resources and start playing really, really well. Really well, probably better than he's ever played before. So the game moves on, and he is winning. The young man is starting to win, and it looks like he's got himself in a position where he's going to be unassailable. He's going to win. And he relaxes, and he relaxes. And as he relaxes, he looks opposite him at this old monk, this old haggard monk who must have been meditating for 30 or 40 years. And what happens in the young man is that he's overcome with compassion. His heart opens to this old man sitting opposite him, who's been summoned by the abbot, who's prepared to not even ask any questions, but prepared to play a game of chess and prepared to die for him, for this young man. And he's very moved by that, and he thinks, well, what have I done with my life? I've done very little of worth. And yet this man opposite me has spent his life trying to accumulate wisdom and truth. And surely his life is worth more than mine. And he deliberately makes a silly move in the game of chess. And the old monk manages to make a decent move. And the young man again makes a false move, deliberately trying to lose. And the old monk makes another move, and the man again makes this false move. And suddenly, the abbot stands up and knocks the pieces off the board and says, enough, enough. And he dismisses the old monk, and he says, no one has won, no one has lost. And then he says to the young man that today you have learnt two things. You've learnt concentration and you've learnt compassion. And since you've learnt compassion, you'll do. Which is lovely, isn't it? You'll do. And the abbot, Banti goes on to say, must have realised that he had on his hands here somebody who was a budding bodhisattva, who could really, really go far in the spiritual life. And I just find that story really moving. Even telling it now, I find it really, really moving. And what it illustrates for me is something to do with... it just brings Vajrasattva to mind for me. This preparedness to let go, to die, to surrender, out of compassion, not out of despair, not out of having lost in life and not being able to go carry on, but out of compassion, letting go of everything, including a preparedness to let go of life itself. And so I called this talk Not About Purity. And when you give talks, you have to, the marketing, the blurb comes out weeks, if not months, in advance on our program, on our website, etc. And I hadn't given it a second of thought by that stage. I just said, Vajrasattva, not about purity. And then I thought, oh dear. Because it sort of is, isn't it? It sort of is. And David, who's been organising the day, has been teasing me for the last few weeks to say, why isn't it about purity then? And I'm sort of thinking, well, perhaps it is. And I even had an email from somebody I don't know, an order member that I don't know in Arialoka in the States, who said that she wanted an article on Vajrasattva. She'd been browsing the web, saw that I was giving a talk called Vajrasattva, Not About Purity. I got really intrigued, and would I send her the talk? And the other. And I had to write back and confess and say, well, actually, no. Partly because the talk hasn't been written yet. And partly because I don't know why it isn't about purity. But then this story comes to mind. And what I think I'm trying to get at, because I am trying to get at something, is that it's not about just following the rules and being good in the conventional sense. This man, this young man, who walked into this monastery, he wasn't a conventionally good man. He wasn't moral in a conventional sense. There was nothing that he'd done in his life that was worthy of that that sort of appellation. He himself thought of himself as somebody who was worthless, and he'd probably done a lot of things that he had right to feel ashamed about. And yet, when the time came, there were these qualities of compassion and awareness in him that were heroic, that are absolutely heroic. And it's a deeper goodness. Goodness isn't even the right word. That we're talking about here. And in a way, Vajrasattva is something deeper. It's as deep as we can possibly go, and deeper still, and then we find Vajrasattva. And when we do, we find that wisdom and compassion within us. That's what we find. That's what Vajrasattva is. Purity in our culture is often just not a very attractive word. When I was ordained, I took up the Vajrasattva sadhana, and I'd felt this connection with this figure for a number of years, but I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure whether it was the right practice for me to take up. Partly because I'd never really been attracted by ethics, Buddhist ethics, and I didn't kind of feel attracted by purity, or wanting to be better or purer. So Subhuti was my preceptor, and I said this to him, fortunately before my ordination. He said, look, which practice do you think, which figure do you think you're going to take up? And I said, well, probably I'd like to take up Vajrasattva, if you think that's the right practice for me. And the first thing he said, yes, that's exactly the right practice for you, which I found very heartening. I then had the presence of mind to say, well, why? And he said he didn't know. It was the right practice. He couldn't say. And then I said, well, I'm not very attracted by purity. And my heart was sort of in my mouth as I said that, because it was a very important thing for me, whether I was going to be given this practice, this practice. And he looked at me very, very squarely, and he said, Vajrasattva is nothing to do with purity. And that was like, it was like a teaching. And I knew what he meant. I knew what he meant. I didn't need to ask, why not? Could you say more? In a way, perhaps it would have been better to. But I knew what he meant. I knew exactly what he meant, and he knew what I meant when I said that I wasn't attracted by purity. And it was a very strong communication that felt somehow that sealed my future, that sealed my bond with Vajrasattva in a certain sense. So what do I mean when I say that I wasn't attracted to purity? Well, I think I had cultural connotations of the word that come from our culture. So purity in our culture is often to do with sex or virginity, isn't it? Or in the Christian context, it is. It's very much to do with, well, the Virgin Mary symbolises purity. And the fact that she's chaste is a virgin. Is a great deal of store is put onto sexual purity, as it were. Also, it has connotations, at least to me, of some sort of weakness, of insipidness, of a sort of overly moralistic kind of attitude. By moralistic, I don't mean... an attitude where we're very over-concerned about whether other people are moral or not. Do you know what I mean? In that sort of rather narrow judging kind of way. In that sort of puritanical way, actually. And those connotations must have been alive in my mind when I said that I wasn't interested in purity. But actually, looking up purity, there are two kind of definitions, aren't there? There is purity in the sense of morally good, and that is associated in our culture with chastity and virginity and all of those things. But also, purity is... It can mean unmixed, yeah? It can mean something that's not got any adulterating substances in it. It's pure in the sense of pure gold, or pure orange juice, to be less archetypal. it's unmixed by anything else. It's concentrated. It's pure in that sense, pure water. And maybe that comes a bit closer to the purity of Vajrasattva. Actually, it's still not the purity of Vajrasattva. Not completely, but it comes a bit closer. So who is Vajrasattva? So I want to say a little bit about who Vajrasattva is, and sort of why, and then a little bit about how we might approach him. Vajrasattva is a figure, an archetypal figure from the Tantric tradition, from the Tibetan Tantric tradition. And so he comes from in a way, a culture very different from ours. But he's a universal archetype. It's a universal archetype that speaks, I think, to all people. He's the embodiment of the five Buddhas of the five Buddha mandala, the five jhanas. So that's why we've got this year of Vajrasattva this year, because the previous 5 years we've been looking at, one by one, the five Buddhas of the five Buddha mandala. And Vajrasattva is often called the sixth Buddha because he brings all of those five together. He is, in a sense, the Buddha's Buddha, as Subhuti once put said to me. Those five, he wears that crown, and on this image, painted by Arlota, this is a copy of a print by a painting by Arlota, he's got a crown of skulls. There are five skulls. But then next to the skulls, behind the skulls, there are these five jewels in the colours of the five Buddhas. So he wears the crown of the five jhanas. So all the wisdoms of the five Buddhas, I'm not going to go through all the wisdoms, and all the qualities of the five Buddhas, all their compassionate qualities, all their altruistic qualities, are embodied together in this one figure. He sits above them. So he's all of them and more. He's more. He, in a way, he's everything. If reality is everything, it's personified in Vajrasattva. He's wisdom, he's compassion, he's all the Buddha qualities in this single form, in this single being. It's said that form, the first form, beyond Vajrasattva in a way, there is no form. So Vajrasattva is the first form out of the realm of no form. And what he is this brilliant, brilliant white light. He's made of brilliant white light. It's white light taken form. And although it's brilliant, it's not cold. Because sometimes it's described as scintillating like sunlight on snow. And it can give somehow an impression that Vajrasattva is beautiful but cold. Somehow very, very distant and very, very cold. But actually, he's not cold. It's full of love. The light of Vajrasattva is the light of compassion and love. He scintillates with all the colours of the rainbow. He's surrounded by this aura of rainbows, of rainbow lights. He holds, of course, the Vajra to his heart, and at his hip he holds the Vajra bell. And there's so much symbolism in each of those implements. I'm not going to be able to go into them. But the Vajra, when Vajrasattva holds it, when it's in conjunction with this bell, The Vajra is the symbol of compassion. He's holding compassion, the very symbol of compassion, to his heart. But it's not just compassion as we know it as an emotion. It's compassion as a quality of reality itself. And he's holding it to the heart. And the bell that he's holding to his hip is the symbol of wisdom, of emptiness, of ultimate penetration into reality, of wisdom. There's all sorts of more that I could say. I mean, for example, the bell is a feminine symbol. Wisdom in the Tibetan tradition is usually personified in female form, and compassion, which is seen as more active, an active engagement in the world, is symbolized in masculine form. Vajrasattva sort of unites masculine and feminine. You talk of him as he, and yet he's androgynous. He's not male. He's sort of above all dualities. All dualities. So he's enlightened consciousness personified. And you might say, well, why bother personifying enlightened consciousness? Wouldn't it be better not to have these personified images, these symbols at all? Because after all, when we start to personify them, don't they start to sound very much like God? So it's a valid question. Why do that? Why personify them? Bhante says that in order to approach enlightenment, in order to start to have a feeling for it, we need to objectify the qualities of wisdom, of compassion, of energy, of love, of fearlessness, of freedom, of bliss. We need to be able to objectify them, actually get a feeling for them, in order to assimilate them and grow into them, develop them, become them. Yeah? So we take symbols as a way of objectifying what wisdom would look like, what compassion would look like. What would it look like to have a mind that was completely unbounded, completely free? This spontaneous play. He's dancing slightly. He's sitting in this Vajrasana posture of stillness, of meditation, yet his upper body is swaying. It's this... I see it as the dance of reality. He's engaging with form, with the world. He's moving. What would it look like to feel those things, to have a wisdom in our mind that was... free of the prison of self, that wasn't self-centered, that was completely objective, that could see the whole universe, the whole cosmos, and not just the material cosmos, but the cosmos of consciousness, just as it is, without filtering it through the lens of I and me and self-centeredness that goes with that. On Friday, I was talking about... Copernicus, Nicholas Copernicus, and I talked about how Copernicus was the first astronomer, at least in the Western world, to posit that the Earth wasn't the centre of the universe. He had this theory that actually the Earth was moving, and that actually the Sun was the centre. And the Church tried to... Well, it was heresy to say that at the time. Galileo was nearly tortured for saying that at the time, or after Copernicus, because it was a huge shift in our worldview. If we on the Earth weren't the centre, where was God then, if God had created us? So what I was arguing on Friday is that we need a Copernican revolution of the mind. We still see ourselves, all of us who are unenlightened, see ourselves, don't we, as the centre of the universe to some degree or other. We still live in this pre-Copernican world where, of consciousness, where I am the most important being in this room and actually on the planet. and we might dress it up in adult ways and not kind of admit to that in such a crude way. And yet emotionally that's how it feels. at a gut level, that's how it feels. What happens to me is really, really important, more so than what happens to anybody else. And that is what prevents us from seeing things as they are. That's the delusion of self that prevents us. So what would it be like to not have that? And what it would be like is this. This is what it would be like. We would be inhabiting a realm of beauty, of love, of complete objectivity that wasn't cold, of connectedness, of play, of stillness, of serenity, and of movement and engagement and dance. So it really helps to have symbols. Banti talks about the transcendental other. Rather than a theistic other, which would be God, a God that's all-powerful and a creator, what Buddhism posits is a transcendental other. So it's a symbol of otherness. And that symbol isn't taken literally by Buddhism, because neither is this notion of other, because self and other are transcended when enlightenment is realized. So we become Vajrasattva when we become enlightened, in a way that in a theistic tradition one can never become God, whereas actually Vajrasattva is our potential. That is who we really are, if we could live up to our potential. And at times in the spiritual life, we can glimpse that. We can glimpse that in ourselves. That young man prepared to die in the Zen monastery, there was a glimpse of something of Vajrasattva in his consciousness when he surrendered, when he lost. So the other reason I think that we really need symbols and archetypes is that if we don't have images like Vajrasattva, we'll invent other images for ourselves. We all live looking for archetypal symbols. And if we don't have ones that point us in the direction of enlightenment, we'll pick up on others that don't. I was thinking of Susan Boyle and Britain's Got Talent. I must confess to having got addicted to Britain's Got Talent when it was on. Am I the only one in the room? I probably am. And Susan Boyle, this woman who emerged, as it were, from nowhere. Well, it was Scotland, but as it were. And sang with this incredible voice that stunned everybody about having a dream. Suddenly became an archetype, yeah? Worldwide. She became a symbol for our human potential that goes beneath or underlies or is beyond our ordinariness. She became a symbol for something much, much bigger. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to carry that symbol. She's not Vajrasattva. She can't hold all the projections that millions of YouTube viewers put onto her, yeah? And well, nobody probably could. So it's a sort of thankless thing to ask somebody, and poor woman suffered for it. And then what happens is that when she disappoints, when she isn't Vajrasattva, and for heaven's sake, she was never going to be, was she? When she isn't Vajrasattva, the media turn on her. And how is that? You know, what do we do? So what I'm saying is we all need archetypes. We do need them. Let's look for them in a place where they will lead us to truth, to who we really can become. You can probably think of others. Okay, so another thing that I want to talk about in terms of Vajrasattva, so that's why we have Vajrasattva, that's a little bit about who Vajrasattva is. One of the things I want to talk about in terms of approaching Vajrasattva is devotion, surrender, letting go. The young man showed the capacity for ultimate surrender, the surrendering of his own life. Vajrasattva, as an archetype, if we engage with him, if we want to really meet him, we will need to surrender our sense of self, our sense of who we are, everything about who we are. Yeah, everything about who we are. So it's not easy to meet Vajrasattva. It's not easy to really, really see Vajrasattva. We have to approach him, as it were, slowly. We have to be prepared to enter into a sort of relationship like you'd enter into a relationship with a lover. You gradually get to know them. And as you gain confidence in that relationship, you're able to open your heart more and let go more. Yeah. Unlike human lovers, Vajrasattva never lets us down. He never, never lets us down. In the sadhana, in the mantra, there's this word samaya, samaya, which means something like bond or oath. And when you take up the Vajrasattva practice, even when you chant the mantra, in a certain sense, you're saying, I'm entering into this bond with Vajrasattva. And what we do is, our job is to try and approach him, to try and be devoted to him and to everything that he represents. And if we do our bit, Vajrasattva meets us. He comes down, as it were, meets us more than halfway. Reality meets us. There's something really mysterious about Buddhist practice. When we make a commitment to the Dharma, all sorts of things start to happen to allow us to fulfill that commitment. Some of those things aren't very pleasant sometimes, but they're opportunities to let go of our selfishness. And it's almost as if the universe responds. This is my experience. This is what my experience is. When I take a step forward and say, yes, okay, I will try and be a bigger, better, less selfish person, the universe sort of responds and says, great, here you go then. And it's not always a challenge. Sometimes it's just love. Sometimes it's just confidence. Sometimes it's just straightforward help. But it is a response. The universe responds. And that's why it's good also to see reality personified. Reality has more of the nature of consciousness than it has of inert matter. The universe isn't inert matter. When we talk in Buddhism about absolute reality, it's got the nature of awareness. So this quality of awareness and compassion, it's not just our potential, it's somehow out there in reality. Of course, that's just a sort of metaphor, a way of speaking, because in there and out there and all break down in the end. But that's certainly how it feels, that reality is aware. Subhuti on my ordination retreat, I mean, he comes to mind very much because I'm talking about, in a way, my ordination. Another thing he said to me, I was talking about some of my experiences that were sort of slightly magical or mystical or something that I'd had since early childhood. And some of them were connected with my father. But my father had died by a long, long time ago. I mean, by the time I was ordained, he'd been dead 20 years. So I wanted to talk to Subhuti about whether actually I was still, at some level, just a Hindu, or whether these experiences that I was having had some sort of explanation in the Buddhist context. And what he said to me is that when you look at reality through certain eyes, reality looks back at you. That's always stayed with me, and it's become, I think, I kind of know what he means. As you develop a relationship with Vajrasattva, it's a two-way thing. It's not just that we imagine this beautiful figure above us and try and devote ourselves to him and chant his mantra, etc. He responds. It looks back. Yeah. So, in a way, that's fantastic. How wonderful. In another way, it's a warning. The Vajrasattva practice is powerful. The mantra is powerful. So if we've been chanting it this morning, bear that in mind. Okay? So letting go, surrender, is a part of that practice. For me, the Vajrasattva practice is beautiful. It's achingly beautiful. And there's an element of longing in it. It's almost like there's a call of longing for Vajrasattva and then a response from him. In the practice itself, the response is tangible. Vajrasattva from his heart, nectar, white nectar, starts to flow, and it flows onto the crown of one's head and fills one with white nectar, and it purifies one in the process. So there's some... And that's sort of, when you do the practice, it's physical. It's physical, it's tangible. So let me just read you a poem that I really like, a poem by Rumi that typifies this letting go for me. I think it's just very, very beautiful. Yeah, let me just read you. It's just a few lines. The way of love is not a subtle argument. The door there is devastation. Birds make great sky circles of their freedom. How do they learn it? They fall. And falling, they're given wings. So Rumi puts it much better than I can about how love, if we're going to tread the way of love, and you could say it's the way of Vajrasattva, how we will need to learn to let go, to fall. And if we can do that with confidence, with Shraddha, with devotion, then we experience the freedom, the ecstatic freedom of birds flying in infinite space. That is what our mind truly is. If we can learn to just let go of this sense of holding on to self, which isn't there in the first place. So what Rumi is talking about there is a death. It's a spiritual death. It's what the young monk in the Zen monastery was doing. It's a spiritual death. And Vajrasattva is associated with spiritual death. He's also associated with physical death. Spiritual death, you don't actually have to die. So nobody's going to jump off a cliff, do you know what I mean, literally, in order to fly. It's not quite like that. But internally, it can feel like that. Internally, it can feel as terrifying as jumping off a cliff, or as blissful as jumping off a cliff and flying, depending on how much we hold on and how much faith we have. Internally, it can feel like that, but physically, it doesn't have to be. But Vajrasattva is also associated with physical death, because it's said that when we die, everything does fall away, whether we like it or not. All our sense of self, our physical self, falls away. Something of consciousness carries on, but it's bewildered. Our consciousness will be bewildered at not having a physical body, not recognizing itself. Yeah? It's said that in that moment of death, the light of reality shines on us. We actually are exposed in a way that's naked to reality. And it's said to be a dazzling white light that appears in our inner vision, appears to the consciousness that's just died in its inner vision. That light is symbolised by Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva appears at the moment of death. That's what it said in the what is literally believed in the Tibetan tradition, and I'm prepared to go along with that. Myself, you don't have to, but I go along with it. And what's said is that we can't handle it, because we haven't prepared in life to let go. We haven't surrendered enough. So we can't handle that moment of reality. It dazzles us, frightens us, and what happens is we shrink back from it, and we take another form, eventually. And So we lose this opportunity of becoming Vajrasattva because we don't recognise that that light of reality is actually our own mind. It's actually who we are. And in failing to recognise it because we've not practised, because we've not meditated, because we've not let go, we lose an opportunity. So Vajrasattva is very associated with death. He's also, his mantra is chanted for people who have just died. As we were chanting this morning, I was just thinking of Michael Jackson. And, I mean, in a way, Michael Jackson is just one death amongst thousands that have probably happened in the last 48 hours. But he was perhaps one of the most famous people to have died in the last 48 hours, and perhaps one of the most sort of unexpected and shocking deaths because of that. And part of me was, at times when I could recall, chanting for him. It's a good thing to do, to chant for the dead. For the just dead, because you're trying to say to their consciousness, recognize yourself. Okay, so I'm going to move on, because I've not much time. So, one of the things that I just really, really want to emphasize is that reality in Buddhism, not in Buddhism, reality in reality, is extremely positive, So the reason that Buddhism asks us to think about death, to think about letting go, etc., is because there's something that's much, much more that we're capable of being, of experiencing. It's extremely positive. It's extremely beautiful. So Buddhism talks about emptiness. We've had lots of readings this morning about emptiness. And emptiness, when Buddhism talks about it, it doesn't mean a black void. It means this scintillating, beautiful, compassionate consciousness of Vajrasattva. That is what happens when we enter into emptiness. When we touch shunyata, it's like we're overwhelmed with how beautiful reality really is, all the time really was. We're overwhelmed with the love that was always there for us, within us, for all beings, for everything. And in that glimpse of shunyata, of reality, of Vajrasattva, what we experience is a sort of paradox. We experience that everything is perfect. The universe is completely perfect. Suddenly we've undergone that Copernican revolution, and the universe is vast. There are galaxies, there are untold distances and visions that open up that are indescribable. Everything is just perfect. And we, in a way, just couldn't see that because we insisted on being the centre of that universe and blotted it all out. So in a certain sense, everything falls into place and it's wonderful. But in another sense, there's another aspect of the paradox. We look and we see this world as we've a world of beings, this earth that we inhabit, and we see the suffering around us. And the love that we feel in response to that suffering turns into compassion. And there's this overwhelming urge to engage with alleviating suffering in the world in whatever way we can. So there's this paradox of actually a deep, deep serenity that sees everything as fine. Even death isn't a problem. And a deep acknowledgement of the suffering in the world and a overwhelming urge that isn't personal. It's like something comes through. It's not personal to help alleviate that suffering wherever and however we can. So the engagement with the world, the alleviation of suffering, the compassion, is what in Buddhism is personified as a bodhisattva. The timeless perfection, the primordial perfection, the serenity, is personified as a Buddha. Yeah? So a Buddha sits in this complete serenity. He is the whole universe. The bodhisattva engages in the world of form, in our world, to help alleviate suffering. And Vajrasattva is both. He's said to be a Buddha who appears in bodhisattva form. So he's both. He unites that duality of eternity and time, of infinity and form and space, of compassion and that wisdom that he holds to his heart. So I'm going to, in a way, start concluding now by saying, well, how in practice do we approach him? I've talked about devotion and I've talked about surrender. Traditionally, the reason we don't see Vajrasattva, the reason that we don't see him within us, we don't see him outside of us, we don't see him in everything, because everything is Vajrasattva if we could only see it. The reason we don't do that is because there are veils obscuring our vision. And there are two veils that are said to be obscuring. One is the veil of klesha, of passions, of emotional attachment, of greed, of hatred, of all the passions that keep us tied down. And the other is the veil of what's called jnaya, which is the veil of ignorance, which is not seeing things as they really are, which is assuming, believing that we are a fixed and separate self around which the universe revolves. We've got it profoundly wrong, both in terms of our views and in terms of our emotional responses. And the veils of klesha and jnaya support each other. They sort of mutually support each other, and they stop us from seeing what's really going on. So the path of removing those veils is a gradual path. You can't just tear down the veil. Actually, if we did, we couldn't handle it. So it's a gradual path. And the path is a path of purification. So it is about purity. In the end, it is about purity. What we're purifying is our passions that restrict us, that keep alive this sense of self. And we're purifying our views that see us as separate and fixed. Yeah? We're purifying both of those things. And everything about Buddhist practice is about that purification. Yeah? Everything is about that purification. Ethics is about that purification, but meditation is also about purification. Study is about purification. Friendship is about purification. Responsibility, altruism is about purification. All of those practices are about thinning this sense of self, thinning those veils, until what happens is you start to get tiny, tiny holes in those veils, and the light shines through. And even though it shines through a tiny fragment of a hole, it's dazzling, and we shrink back. But gradually we get used to it. We get used to that dazzling light of Vajrasattva, and the holes we can, or the veils we can thin even further. And ultimately, yes, perhaps we can just tear down those veils that obscure reality. And when we do that, the path of purification is complete, and what we realise is that the veils were somehow never needed to be there, that it was something that we'd got profoundly wrong, that actually there was nothing to purify. Nothing to purify because we never were a fixed self. That's what Buddhism means by emptiness. There's nothing fixed. And if there's nothing fixed, there's nothing essentially impure, just as there's nothing essentially pure in the sense of good and evil, or right and wrong. Vajrasattva somehow is a purity that's beyond purity in that sense. It's a purity that's beyond all our notions, including good, evil, etc. But the path there is definitely a gradual one, and a path where ethics matters. Yeah? So we need the both. We need the both. We need the path, and we need the sense of a goal that's profoundly optimistic, that says that actually at any moment all we have to do is just change our perspective. If we could just change our perspective, like that young man in that Zen monastery, from self to selflessness, from holding on to letting go, from grabbing to surrendering, from being earthbound to flying, if we could just change our perspective, and that's a matter of something that happens moment to moment, if we could just do that, the veils would fall away. Even if they fall away for a moment, they would fall away, and all there would be the light, the beautiful light, the scintillating, radiant light of Vajrasattva. Thank you very much.